Support comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The complexity of the human brain probably rivals anything else in the known universe. Last week, President Obama touched on that fact in his announcement of a new initiative to fund brain research.
There's this enormous mystery waiting to be unlocked. And the Brain Initiative will change that by giving scientists the tools they need to get a dynamic picture of the brain in action and better understand how we think and how we learn and how we remember. And that knowledge could be, will be, transformative.
The Brain Initiative will fund research into diseases of the brain, but also into better understanding the ways our brains work. About $20 million of the fund are slated to fund research through the National Science Foundation. Joining us now from the National Science Foundation in Arlington, Virginia, is Dr. John Wingfield. He is Assistant Director for Biological Sciences there. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
The president compared the Brain Initiative to the Human Genome Project. Do you think that's a good comparison?
In terms of complexity, yes. Of course, they're very different things. And a lot of the information we have from the human genome and other genome sequences will aid in the brain research that is being proposed.
There is already a lot of brain research going on. There's been huge advances in just very recent years. To hear the president talk about it, though, it sounds like it's been somewhat static.
I think the way to approach this is that the president is issuing a call to action. You're quite right. There's an awful lot of brain research going on. There have been a lot of advances. And this is on a very, very, very broad front. And with this announcement, I think it focuses all on a specific end goal, which may have been there, may have not. But now the president has called us to action. I think that's good. It will focus our attention more, and we can direct what is already going on, identify where the gaps in our knowledge are, where the technological problems are the greatest, and we can focus on overcoming those and achieve the goals.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday. My guest, Dr. John Wingfield, he's the Assistant Director for Biological Sciences for the National Science Foundation. We're talking about the president's proposal for the brain initiative. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Wingfield, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. $100 million is what the president's proposing at this point, and really that's a drop in the bucket these days. Is that more of a symbolic gesture in your mind?
I think it's it mentions a specific amount that we can focus on the future of this particular goal. It is a drop in the bucket when you consider the NIH budget and NSF's budget, DARPA and so forth, and other agencies that are involved in neuroscience. But I think it's good to focus some funds at the outset so we can at least see the way forward over the next 5, 10 years or even more that it will take to achieve the goals the president outlined.
Tell us about the research that's currently underway at the National Science Foundation that could link to this kind of funding and expand on it.
Yes. Neuroscience at the National Science Foundation involves all of our directorates, essentially, including engineering, math, physical sciences, social behavioral, economic sciences, education, human resources, as well as bio and others, computer information in science and engineering. So NSF is very uniquely placed to bring together all of these domain sciences to address the issues of developing technology, the tools to for example, actually view, image and record human brain activity and map all the connections. This involves biological expertise, engineering, mathematics, physics, as well as computational sciences. And the social and behavioral economic sciences have a very important role to play in terms of cognitive neuroscience in how we actually compare healthy brains with diseased or damaged brains, and how we actually then can figure out what has gone wrong and what then needs to be put right. So we are advancing in all of these areas, and we expect in the next few years to focus more and more on developing the tools and the concepts to achieve these goals. And as I said, NSF is uniquely poised to bring together all of these domain sciences to collaborate on this.
The private sector is pursuing a lot of this as well. To what extent can the NSF and other government and quasi-governmental agencies work and bring it all together where the private enterprise is concerned?
Well, I think we all have to stay in communication, and there are a number of ways that we can do that. For example, industry has specific goals in mind, usually, whereas the NSF is funding basic research and unsolicited proposals. We fund not only work on mammal neuroscience, but we do a lot in insects and fish and other organisms that have a simple nervous system as a model to figure out how neurons interact and then scale up to much more complex nervous systems such as that of the human. So you have that full gamut from basic research that is not goal-oriented at all to issues that industry is interested in solving, and the NIH with the more translational research and so forth. So I think we will all be moving forward in our own research interests, but I see this call for the Brain Initiative to actually keep us more in contact, possibly through workshops and other ways to make sure that we're all on the same page and we understand what each other is doing.
About, as I said earlier, about $20 million of the fund is slated for the NSF. What do we know about how the money's being doled out?
Well, I think we'll find out about that this afternoon when the president announces his budget. You know, I think we will be asked to allocate our own funds. I don't know. The people feel that there are that there is new money here. We don't know until the president actually rolls that out this afternoon. But I can say that the NSF is investing about $20 million or so a year. That will continue with flat budgets. And when budgets increase, then we will try and increase that commitment. So I'm afraid I can't really answer that question definitively, but we will find out this afternoon.
What are you most excited about? I have to tell you, there doesn't, not a week goes by, it seems, that I'm not talking about in one way or another brain elasticity, you know, the brain scans that they're able to do now. It's just, it's a constant drumbeat now of issues that are coming up, treating Alzheimer's, implanting pacemakers in brains and so forth. It seems amazing, but it's happening all the time now.
Oh, it is. Every day brings new revelations, and I think the interface of biology, social sciences, engineering, mathematics, physics, and computational issues now allow us to develop sensors, different ways of recording in multiple areas of the brain or very, very specific areas of the brain. And being able to image this, record it, and then analyze it, there are discoveries being made every day that enable us to do that more efficiently and more accurately and more precisely. And that's going to continue. It is very exciting indeed. It's a wonderful time to be in biology.
Pardon me?
It's a wonderful time to be in the biological sciences and other domain sciences that are focused on neuroscience.
Is there any concern that, or is there any sense about what's going to get the most attention first? How, you know, the things that we hear the most about, Alzheimer's, for instance, just the issues that we hear the most about, are they going to tend to get the most attention, do you think?
I think that's certainly the case along the more translational lines of the research that NIH will be doing, DARPA is interested in, and industry. But for us here at the National Science Foundation, we focus on the basic science.
Mm-hmm.
At the neuron level or at the brain level, social sciences level, we actually focus on answering those very, very fundamental questions. Those then can be exploited by the more mission-oriented agencies and industry to translate that information into clinical outcomes.
Okay. Well, Dr. John Wingfield, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome, and thank you for asking.
Dr. John Wingfield, he's the Assistant Director for Biological Sciences for the National Science Foundation. The NSF is... perhaps will be the beneficiary of about $20 million of the fund slated by the president for the new brain initiative. When we return, we'll continue our conversation on Wellness Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, a big second look at capitalism, how it's worked over time, how it hasn't, and whether it's run its course. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. 76 degrees with a mix of sun and clouds today. There's about a 30% chance of a pop-up shower or thunderstorm, a high near 80. The Council for Older Adults of Delaware County can help reduce the stress of caring for older relatives by providing tools and support needed to keep loved ones living safely and independently at home. More information is available by calling 740-363-6677 or online at growingolder.org. And support comes from the Homeport Nobo on Long Condominiums, offering homeownership opportunities in the King Lincoln District, featuring green design buildings within walking distance of local stores and restaurants. Details at homeportohio.org/NOBO on Long. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Young people make up about 40% of the new HIV infections in America. With that in mind, it is hard to believe that today marks the first ever National Youth HIV and AIDS Awareness Day. I guess it's about time. Joining us now to discuss the risk of HIV infection among young people is Tyler Termeer. He is director of the Ohio AIDS Coalition and AIDS Resource Center, Ohio's Prevention Department. Welcome to the show, Tyler.
Thank you.
Also with us is Devin Quinn. He's a client of ARC Ohio who is going to share his story today. Welcome, Devin.
Thank you for having me.
So when we're talking about youth, Tyler, what do we mean by that? Define who we're what the age group is.
So we're really talking about those between the age of 13 and 29 who currently are at the highest risk for HIV infection and the one group that we continue to see increases of HIV infection in the United States. And that's mirrored here in Ohio communities as well.
Why are they at highest risk?
So I think as the epidemic has progressed, we have seen a lot of silence and complacency set into the epidemic. Our communities are not talking about HIV in the ways that they were earlier on in the epidemic, when people were a lot sicker and dying a lot more from the epidemic. As medications have progressed, people are living long and manageable lives with HIV, and it doesn't have the same fear factor, I think, for a lot of communities that it once had.
To what extent do young people tend to misunderstand that, per se? In other words, we hear about polio. They're right down to a couple hundred cases left in the world. Do younger people have that sense that it's going away and being cured in that way?
You know, I think it's a combination of things. I think there's the perception that it's gone away, but there's also, we're dealing with a generation that has never lived a day where HIV wasn't on this planet, and also that never lived during a time when people were so sick and weren't taking handfuls of pills to manage the virus or keep it at bay. So now we have a treatment regimen where individuals can take one pill once a day and often have very few, if any, side effects to their medications. So with very little conversation and very little of folks seeing sick, I think it's much harder to keep that focus.
I guess the best education is to show people what can go wrong, and you can't do that anymore as well. So what is being done? Is it part of curriculum in schools? What's out there?
So that's an interesting question. I think it depends on where you live in the country. And here in Ohio, we're fortunate to have some school districts that are teaching comprehensive sexual education. However, Ohio is predominantly an abstinence-only state. And so it's not truly being taught in the way necessary to empower young people to have the effective tools to talk to their partners and to navigate safer sex conversations.
Is sex the main issue, or is IV drug use at all part of this equation?
So I think we're starting to see an increase of IV drug use in certain parts of the state. If you are at all monitoring the spike in heroin use around the state of Ohio, along with that obviously will come a small spike in HIV infection with those individuals who are sharing needles. So we obviously are a state right now that doesn't have a very active syringe exchange program, although there are several parts of the state that are pushing very hard. There's actually some current legislation that has been introduced by Representative Antonio to try and push for legalizing cities' ability to offer a clean needle exchange.
They've tried that many, many times in the legislature and have always failed.
Correct. Unfortunately, And we know that it will work, which is, I think, the scariest part about it.
Devin Quinn, you're a client at the AIDS Resource Center. Devin, how old are you?
I'm 23.
So you fit into that 13 to 29 category. Tell us your story.
I was diagnosed May 15th of last year. I had been getting tested regularly for every 3 to 6 months, and actually my previous negative test had been in January, so there was a short window. So I am very fortunate in the fact that I was tested positive so early. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I was able to connect with the resources available to me and begin treatment plans and set out a plan for health so I can maintain a healthy lifestyle.
So you were, you know, wise enough to be tested routinely.
Correct.
And yet you still...
Like many young people, I made a dumb decision at a dumb age.
Okay.
And
it just takes one dumb decision,
it does,
right?
It really does. And I feel that now I'm in a position, I'm only a year older, but I'm considerably wiser and far more educated on the subject, where I can speak to people my age. And I have spoken to many people my age about the risk factors involved and the conversations you should be having with potential partners and those things that you need to be doing to maintain safer sexual practices and safer overall health, mentally, physically, all over.
Where do you go to proselytize? Where are you going? Who are you reaching?
Mainly it's just been within my community. I've talked to a lot of people that I've I hang out with, and I've actually had several people whom I'm close with and whom I'm not come to me and express their concerns about their sexual health and what should they do and who should they talk to, and because they may have come from a more conservative background and they weren't connected with the resources or even well-educated on how to process the emotions that they're dealing with when it comes to their sexual health, which is a very daunting task if we don't empower people with the tools they need to help themselves. Then we're going to have a bigger problem on our hands.
Tyler Tremere, where are you hoping Devin Quinn and others like him who are willing to share their stories, where do you want to send them? Where do you want them to go?
You know, I think that there are many opportunities for people who are living with HIV to receive very optimal health care. We're very fortunate in Ohio to have a lot of resources at our hand. AIDS Resource Center Ohio has a brand new medical center and pharmacy located on High Street that is offering a very holistic opportunity for individuals to walk in the door, maybe find out that they're HIV positive through our HIV testing net program, and immediately be able to be linked to primary care or HIV specialty care. They can receive mental health services, talk to a social worker, and get their medications filled all in the same home, really.
But reaching the younger people, particularly kids that are still living in their parents' homes and are scared. I mean, how do you, and you know, you mentioned that Ohio is generally an abstinence only sex education state. What kind of outreach can you achieve?
So we are fortunate in that we do have some school systems through their health programs or physical education programs that will let us in the door to talk to their students. But I think that we have tried to think of other areas where we can be innovative or bring awareness. So, for example, we have an annual AIDS walk, which is actually coming up in the next week, Saturday, April 20th, where folks can come out to Bicentennial Park, registration at 9 a.m. The walk and run kicks off shortly thereafter, and bring awareness to the epidemic of what's happening. But then we've also taken recently some very innovative steps in trying to reach a younger demographic through the launching of a new mobile app for smartphones available both on iPhones and the Android system called the HIV Risk Meter, which allows folks to answer a series of 2 to 3 questions that will assess their risk for HIV infection and then refers them to a local testing site in their area.
So we'll post a link to the AIDS Resource Center Ohio on our website if you want to learn more about the annual AIDS Walk on April 20th and also the HIV Risk Meter. It just asks a couple questions, like what?
So it's going to ask you whether or not you have engaged in various types of sexual activity, whether or not you are using protection, and who your potential partners may have been. Not names, obviously, but what population they may have been from. And that will assess your risk based on those few questions, low to high.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests are Tyler Tremere. He's director of the Ohio AIDS Coalition and the AIDS Resource Center Ohio's Prevention Department. Also with us is Devin Quinn. He is a client of the AIDS Resource Center. Today is the first ever National Youth HIV and AIDS Awareness Day. If you have a question or comment for either Tyler Tremere or Devin Quinn, give us a call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So with the risk meter, the HIV risk meter, they answer a few questions and then what do they get back?
So they after they answer a few questions, a screen will pop up that will tell them whether or not they are anywhere from low to high risk for HIV or STD infection. And then it gives them the opportunity to link to a local HIV testing site in their region. So this is a project funded by the Ohio Department of Health. The team that also runs the Ohio AIDS STD HIV hotline helped to design this mobile app to refer folks both to the hotline, both the phone number and the website, but also to refer folks in a much easier real-time way through their mobile phone.
Has it launched?
It has launched. So you can go to either your iPhone or your Android application store and just search for HIV Risk Meter, and it will pop right up for you. It is a free mobile app.
Devin, what are you telling people that really reaches them? There's a lot of technical, clinical type of language you can use that you've been listening to now for almost a year since you discovered that you're HIV positive. But what emotional, at what emotional level, how do you break through that? Yeah, but it's not going to happen to me, because that's a big problem, right, Tyler? It's the age group is it's not going to happen to me.
Right. I mean, so much has changed to
nothing's going
to
happen to me.
The epidemic, mm-hmm. and people are, you know, people just aren't as afraid of it as they once were. So I think it's that pendulum. You know, it swung a little bit too far where we have tried to address the stigmatization of people living with HIV and tried to make sure that people weren't afraid of people living with HIV. But at the same time, some of that silence and complacency I talked about earlier has swung that pendulum a little too far.
So, Devin, what do you think?
I would completely agree. The complacency attitude amongst my age group is a little overwhelming, and the education rate amongst my age group is astounding in terms of lack thereof. As I was talking to someone earlier today,
and you didn't grow up learning much about it.
I didn't, but I'm very fortunate to come from a place where it was very necessary to talk about these things, and it goes to prove that you can be as educated as the next person and more aware than anyone else, and you can still make mistakes. And I think that's a problem people come up against a lot. When something like this happens to them, they feel, well, I was smart enough. Why did this happen to me? And from an emotional perspective, you become very overwhelmed. And that's where we need to tap into people, is just, you know, put that hand on the shoulder and say, this is not an experience you have to go through alone. There are resources, and if you want to be confidential about it, it can remain completely confidential. I, from the beginning, decided to put my best foot forward and speak openly about this, because I felt that if I could share my experience, it could be beneficial to others, especially in my age group. So
I guess on one level, you're trying to prevent it altogether. On the other level, you're trying to get people to come forward and get the best possible care they can as soon as possible.
That's correct. And I think that's why these awareness days are so important. And you said earlier, it is interesting that this is the first time we've seen a national youth HIV/AIDS Awareness Day. And I have to agree. I mean, I think that young people for a number of years have been one of the only populations that we've continued to see an increase among. Right now, I think we're striving really hard to reach young people and to get young people like Devin who are willing to share their story. I know even for myself, as a person living with HIV, I've been living with the virus for about 9 years, and the resources and available for young people is still very limited in the amount of time since I've been living with the virus.
What kind of legal rights does a minor have to seek your help and your guidance without their parental consent?
So in terms of the prevention side, individuals in the state of Ohio can get tested without parental consent as early as the age as 13. And then on the care side, there are programs through the nationwide Children's Hospital that will see clients. We obviously recommend that individuals have a strong support system in place, but recognize that not everyone has that. And so there is the availability to access resources, whether you have parental consent or not.
We have just a few minutes left with Tyler Tremere, director of the Ohio AIDS Coalition and the AIDS Resource Center, Ohio's Prevention Department, and Devin Quinn as well. He's a client of the AIDS Resource Center. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Can we talk about pockets of the state? Are there pockets of the state that are seeing more, having a higher incidence of this than others? Because when we look at that 40% number, that's averaged over the whole nation. Is it pretty much parallel in Ohio? And does it settle more intensely in the urban areas or the suburban areas? What do we know about it?
So I think we know that the three C's, Columbus, Cincinnati, and Cleveland, are going to see larger rates of new infections. But part of that also will have to do with people who live in more rural parts of the state not wanting to get tested in their region,
mm-hmm.
Or even seek medical care in their region because of the stigma associated still with the disease. Columbus actually was just named a new Ryan White Part A city, which essentially means that we've reached a new level of the epidemic in which they recognize that the increased number of new infections in the state requires an additional amount of money for us to address the health disparities associated with the virus.
And, of course, Ryan White is that boy back in the 80s who was infected with HIV because of a blood transfusion. He was a hemophiliac. He became an outcast in his school and then a hero, he and his mother together, for standing up for his rights.
Right. And in so many ways, Ryan White became the face that we needed in the epidemic, one that wasn't going to cause controversy. It's interesting. I was just having a conversation with someone recently, and the question came up, does anyone know how old Ryan White would be today if he had lived? Because everyone thinks of him as this young boy, or you see images of
him
as this young boy. So he was about 13 at the time. And so I believe he would have been 41 years old this year.
That's something. He was both a youth and he had contracted it through a blood transfusion. And it brought out the whole issue of whether you – it doesn't matter how you got it.
Right. HIV is a disease that's not discriminating and it's impacting each and every population.
Dorothy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Dorothy.
Hi. I have a question about the HIV home test kits that I'm starting to see advertised on television. And I'm wondering how positive results are relayed to people who submit samples. I mean, is there counseling directly included in that? How do they deal with that?
So the HIV home test is you know, it's another tool out there on the market for individuals who may not feel the comfort or the safety to go to a clinic or a service organization that's offering the test. It is the same rapid HIV test that would be used if you went to a clinic that offers that free rapid test or to a place like AIDS Resource Center Ohio. The difference is that you're going to be taking that test within the comfort of your own home. And you would administer the test yourself, and you would find out the results of that test yourself. There is a national hotline that you can call and speak to an individual to talk through your result and to get referred to a local resource. But there's obviously not the same comfort level of being with a clinician or with a social worker or a trained coordinator that's going to be able to immediately answer your questions and immediately get you linked to care.
All right, Dorothy, thanks for that question. Devin Quinn, when you found out you tested positive, what went through your mind, and how did you come to that point of dealing with it so maturely and responsibly and in all the ways that you are?
Well,
because you couldn't have felt that way for at least a second. You had to feel that.
No, I did not.
It was
a very overwhelming moment. I actually collapsed at my home. Because I received a phone call, and it was a very emotionally trying period. And I happened to be with a friend of mine, and the counselor who I was speaking with over the phone asked if I could immediately come in and get connected just to talk about what was going on. And I just had this overwhelming urge to just start moving and start hitting the ball rolling. I didn't want to suffer or try to make this any worse than it was. My attitude was, I have an illness. When you have an illness, you go to a doctor, and this is what you have to do. So it was very emotionally trying for the first few weeks, of course. But immediately, an hour later after I received the phone call, once connected with the resources and the counselors, I was just overwhelmingly comforted and knew that I was going to be fine and that there were so many resources and so much available to me to make me feel all right physically and emotionally.
So how has your life changed? Do you take a pill every day? I mean, what do you do?
I do not. I am not on a medicinal regimen as of yet. My doctor and I have decided that it's not necessary at this point, but that will be coming up soon. So I am currently in the period of exploration when it comes to what medicine I might want to be taking. My life has changed dramatically as far as perspective. Nothing you do every day is the same. Every thought you have, it's almost like having a second conscience. It's in the back of your mind all the time. If you look at someone you find attractive, if you're walking down the street, if you feel that you might want to go on a date with someone, the disclosure laws we have in this state are in my opinion, oddly puritanical.
Meaning?
Well, if you decide to have sexual intercourse with someone in the state of Ohio and you are HIV positive, you are under a legal obligation to inform them, which I think is the correct thing to do. It's something I have always been an advocate for, is disclosure. But the result of not disclosing that information can result in very heavy penalization legally. And I think that might be the wrong approach to that. But my life in retrospect has changed in the fact that I'm more aware. I'm willing to be an advocate. I've begun blogging about my experiences and how they progress and how I'm entering treatment, because my problem with this whole issue from the beginning was no one's talking about it. We talk about advocacy and, you know, awareness, but we don't talk about, well, all right, you're diagnosed. What do you do now? Where do we go? What are the steps that you have to take? How is the process? What is the mental aspect? Do you need counseling? Do you need a therapist? Do you have that support network in place? How do we get from point A to point E? Those resources are available, but we don't really talk to the general public about how easy it is to get to them, and also what is necessary to get to them.
Before you leave, we'll make sure we get a link to your blog and post it on our website at WOSU.org, along with the link to the AIDS Resource Center Ohio. Devin Quinn, thanks for joining us today to
talk
about it.
Thank you for having me.
And Tyler Tremere of Ohio AIDS Coalition and the AIDS Resource Center Ohio's Prevention Department, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having us.
We will continue Wellness Wednesday after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the evolution of the new military intelligence complex, in which the CIA does targeted killings and the military's special forces take on spying missions. We talk with Mark Mazzetti, a national security correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Way of the Knife, The CIA, A Secret Army, and a War at the Ends of the Earth. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in just about 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News, 73 degrees in downtown Columbus. About a 50% chance of a pop-up shower today, a high near 80. Also a 50% chance of a pop-up shower tonight, a low of 60. Support for 89.7 comes from Green Bean Delivery, offering home delivery of fresh organic produce and natural groceries, striving to make healthy eating more accessible to the communities of Greater Columbus. Details on Green Bean Delivery's products, as well as how to place an order, can be found online at greenbeandelivery.com. And support for All Sides comes from Ohio State's College of Arts and Sciences, presenting a new take on the tragic tale of Carmen. Performances of an unconventional chamber version take place April 13th and 14th at Ohio State's Thurber Theater. More information at music.osu.edu. All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. For anyone who has asthma or has a friend or a loved one with asthma, maybe a coworker, you know how bad an attack can be. People who suffer from asthma can usually figure out ways to avoid an episode, but that's not the case when a new or unforeseen trigger sets them off. Joining us now to talk about that is Dr. Diane Gorgas. She is Residency Director for the Department of Emergency Medicine at the OSU Wexner Medical Center. Fancy way to say you are working. You're an ER doctor.
I'm an ER doc. That's right. Great to be here, Ann. Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about why people have asthma in the first place?
That's a great question. And asthma, despite us doing studies and research on asthma for years, is still a bit of an enigma. We know that there are multiple components of the disease. There's bronchospasm, or when the muscles tighten down around the airways and actually physically constrict them. There's swelling within the airways, or edema, and there's increased mucus production within the airways. But trying to figure out why a person develops asthma, there are a lot of different theories out there, some genetic, some environmental, some allergic, some risk factors that can be controlled by patients as well. But right now it's a little bit of a mystery.
Is asthma caused by something else, or is someone born with asthma, or is that one of the things we don't know?
Most asthma is developed, usually within the childhood years, but there is such a thing as adult onset asthma, and it's actually becoming more and more common. The component of asthma, or the proportion of the population that's affected with adult onset asthma after the age of 40, is actually increasing over time. One of the thoughts behind that is it's because it's related to exposure to irritants and pollution within the air that act as triggers.
My guest is Dr. Diane Gorgas of the OSU Wexner Medical Center Emergency Department. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. We're talking about asthma. Do you have asthma? Do you know how you got it? Give us a call and tell us your story, 614-292-8513. Is the adult onset asthma in any way more serious because people don't pay as close of attention to it? They don't have a mommy or a daddy there taking them to the pediatrician to find out why they're breathing funny?
Yeah, absolutely. And the differential diagnosis, so the list of other problems that could be causing the symptoms, is much broader when somebody presents as an adult. We need to think about problems all the way from the vocal cords, and could this be just a vocal cord problem, spasm of the vocal cords, all the way down through the bronchioles, through the major airways, and a lot of times even heart problems can present like asthma. There's such a thing called cardiogenic wheezing, when the lungs fill up with fluids from a heart problem, but it can look all the world like asthma.
Now, we see in the movies the stereotypical asthma attack is someone's not getting their medicine, they don't have their inhaler handy, there's some crisis, it's a movie after all, and they start having an asthma attack and they can't breathe. Is that typical? Does that happen a lot to people?
It does happen a lot to people, and this is one of the situations where art absolutely imitates life. And I don't know that most of the time it's more dramatic and more frightening in real life. When a patient can't get air, I cannot imagine a scarier situation. If you remember that old commercial that was put out by the Asthmatic Association of the goldfish in like half an inch of water in the bottom right of a bowl, that is really what it's like watching somebody have difficulties breathing. It's frightening for the patient, and it's also frightening for we as caregivers. We have a big armamentarium of treatments and resources that we can use, but there's a lot of empathy that goes into treating people with shortness of breath.
So when someone shows up at the ER and is having trouble breathing and maybe they don't even know they have asthma, what do you do?
There's a systematic way to approach people with breathing problems. We start from the top and make sure that there's no obstruction of the airway, clearing the airway if that's the situation, making sure that they have adequate breathing. If their airway's not secure, the first thing that we have to do is put down a breathing tube and put them on a ventilator, and then start to uncover the different layers of the onion that we can unpeel to try and figure out what the cause of the breathing difficulty is.
There are some studies now that show diet can impact asthma.
Absolutely. In the old days, a lot of asthma treatment was really focused on bronchospasm, on that muscular contraction around the airways. What we're finding now is that many of the therapies are moving towards trying to correct the swelling within the airways, the inflammation within the airways, and that's where we really think diet can have a big component. A high-fat diet not only makes swelling within the airways much more likely, it makes the response to the bronchodilator treatments, the inhalers that people take, much less predictable and less effective.
Why is that? Do we know?
High-fat diets actually trigger inflammation. It's the same reason that high-fat diets are bad for cardiovascular health, in that they can cause inflammation of the coronary arteries and cause clotting of the coronary arteries. We also know that Americans who eat more soy, and we're really bad at eating soy as Americans here in the U.S., but we know that people that eat more soy have better lung functions, better measurable pulmonary functions. And we think that that can maybe positively impact somebody's life if they're struggling with asthma.
So maybe even if you drink soy milk once a day, it would be helpful?
Exactly, especially if you're substituting that for whole milk.
Right, for the fattier whole milk, right.
Exactly.
What about children who suffer from asthma, the kinds of treatments they take? What kind of long-term considerations are there for those?
There are a lot of long-term considerations, especially when asthma is poorly controlled and there's not an eye towards preventing severe asthma reactions. Patients, especially pediatric patients who come into the emergency department frequently for their asthma, get placed on steroids. It is one of the mainstays of therapy for poorly controlled asthma. Steroids affect the hormonal axis, they affect growth, they affect long-term bone density. There's all sorts of deleterious effects from chronic steroid use, and we certainly don't want to see that occur, especially in children.
So are pediatricians paying attention to that?
I think the pediatricians are doing an excellent job about asthma control, but there will always be kind of a subset of patients and patient families that attend to emergencies and not to chronic preventative care. And I think the pediatric community is really pushing prevention, pushing control, as opposed to using the emergency department as the stopgap measure.
Here's an interesting twist, I thought, was the use of Botox, affect asthma. Tell us about that.
Well, the first component that I mentioned of asthma, the bronchospasm, or the tightening down of the muscles surrounding the airways, that is the mainstay of therapy for how Botox works. It actually is a paralytic. It disables muscles from contracting. So the big wrinkles that you get in your forehead from the muscles contracting over
time. It's from thinking, but go on.
It shows our wisdom, but nonetheless, we don't want very wise airways. We want them nice and open and free and air moving in and out of them. One of the areas where it's shown to be really helpful is an upper airway problem when the vocal cords become irritated and their closing becomes dysfunctional. It's a situation that's a little bit different from asthma and that it's not characterized by true wheezing in the lower lungs. It's a different sound. It occurs at a different time in the respiratory cycle. In medicine, we call it stridor, but it's that kind of sound that you get as opposed to the exhaling sound that you get with wheezing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But Botox injections into the vocal cords have been shown to be effective at helping relax the vocal cords and return them to normal function. So there are some scientists out there and clinicians who are thinking about using Botox in the lower airways to try and decrease the spasticity and the muscle tightness of the lower airways, which may improve asthma.
It makes me wonder, what was Botox developed for in the first place? Was it developed to do what, you know, we're familiar with it doing, which is kind of facial or,
It's a great question. Botox is a naturally occurring substance. It's short for botulism toxin. So when you hear of people being poisoned with botulism and becoming paralyzed or weak from botulism, it's a naturally occurring disease process. We don't see it very often these days. Most of us eat canned food from the grocery store and don't can our own foods, really, where that is the biggest risk factor for developing botulism. But it's also why we don't feed honey to kids less than the age of 1 year, because it can be very small amounts of botulism in that can affect infants and don't affect older children. But realizing that toxic substance, that toxin that botulism creates, had some medicinal and beneficial side effects of muscle relaxation is how we came upon that drug.
And was it always immediately used for? The word is escaping me, but for looks, for
cosmetic purposes. No, botulism has a long history of being used for all sorts of disorders in medicine, and specifically disorders of muscle spasticity, trying to relax the muscles.
So a lot of kids, a lot of people just carry around inhalers that are sometimes, you know, they may not have episodes of asthma, you know, any kind of attack for years on end, some people, but they carry that same inhaler with them all the time. Can you give us any advice about how old that inhaler should be, how often you should get a fresh inhaler, that sort of thing?
Inhalers have a shelf life of about a year.
Okay.
And shouldn't be used after that. I'm happy to hear when somebody carries around an expired inhaler as opposed to no inhaler at all. It also tells me that their asthma is relatively well controlled, which is a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want people to use expired medicine. In a pinch, using expired pharmaceuticals as opposed to nothing at all, especially when we're talking about asthma inhalers, is probably okay, but it's a much better idea to keep those inhalers fresh so that you get full benefit out of the medication.
And as far as overusing the inhalers, can you do that? Can they be dangerous? Can there be a bad effects from that?
Absolutely. These medications, the reason that they're given in an inhaled form are that we are hopeful that they locally stay within the pulmonary tree and they act locally. There is always some systemic absorption of the medication, and all asthma inhalers, especially the ones that you can get over the counter, the epinephrine type of derivatives like Primatene, can really have systemic consequences. They are all stimulants. They will make you feel nervous. They will make you feel jittery. They will increase your heart rate, which, kind of cycling back to what we were talking about, asthma as a potential for presentation as cardiac disease. I've taken care of patients before who mistook their cardiac disease for asthma, used a family member's inhaler, and ended up with a rapid heart rate, a rising blood pressure that only worsened their heart condition.
Once again, another cautionary tale about not using someone else's drugs.
I think that we could talk all day about cautionary tales of not using someone else's drugs, yes.
And the environment. In some ways, you know, it's getting better. We were talking earlier about casinos. At least there's no smoking, someone said,
exactly,
anymore. And so things are better. Are you seeing any benefits from the no smoking bans and that sort of thing? Is there any way to measure that?
Absolutely. People that have irritant-triggered asthma, which is a large subset of asthmatic patients, are now able to travel, enjoy outdoor activities more, enjoy going to a casino, going to a restaurant, going to a bar without those limitations. This is, in a sense, though, being offset by the general level of environmental pollutants in the air. We all can relate, especially as summer is coming along, to those respiratory warning days that we see on the news that say if you have a history of asthma, you shouldn't be outside.
Seems like there are more every summer, too.
It seems like there are more every summer. And here in Columbus, especially those people that have allergy-related asthma, have a really rough time of it. We're just coming into the peak tree pollen, and spring in Ohio is beautiful, but it really does wreak havoc on people with respiratory illnesses where airway inflammation is a component of it.
Diane Gorgas, thanks for joining us again today.
Thanks so much for having me, and I appreciate it.
Dr. Diane Gorgas, she's residency director in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Wexner Medical Center. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher today. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.